Y'all, I just finished Author Accelerator's book coaching course and submitted my materials, and let me tell you, I learned a ton. If you've been listening for a while, you know I spent 5 years as an editor with the New York Times, but I still had a lot to learn about helping writers through the process of taking a book from idea to manuscript, and I loved learning it with the Author Accelerator team. What they taught me has changed my approach to editing completely. I didn't just learn how to help a writer move from one stage of the process to the next. I learned how to help them appreciate how far they've come and feel excited about what's coming next, see their strengths and how they can build on them, and trust me to guide them into the hard work that lies ahead. If you'd like to learn more about coaching, fiction or nonfiction, then you need to visit www.bookcoaches.com to learn more.
Is it recording?
Now it's recording.
Yay! Go ahead.
This is the part where I stare blankly at the microphone. Try to remember what I'm supposed to be doing.
All right, let's start over.
Awkward pause.
I'm going to wrestle some papers.
Okay.
Now 1, 2, 3. Okay.
Hey, I'm KJ Delantonia, and this is #AmWriting, the weekly podcast about writing all the things, short things, long things, fiction, nonfiction, pitches, proposals. This is, as I say nearly every week when I manage to remember all of it, this is the weekly podcast about sitting down and getting your work done. And today, y'all are hearing just from me, so I get to go ahead and introduce myself. I am KJ Delantonia, the author of the novel The Chicken Sisters, as well as the forthcoming novel In Her Boots, out in the summer of 2022, and the former editor and lead writer of the Motherload blog at the New York Times, and the author of the nonfiction book How to Be a Happier Parent, and that's, you know, pretty much my bio. And I'm going to be sitting here today talking to a guest, and I'm really excited about it. With me in just a moment, I will let her speak, is Kate Doty. She is the author of Mergers and Acquisitions, or Everything I Know About Love, I Learned on the Wedding Pages. And relevantly from that, she is a writer and former editor at the New York Times, where she covered, you guessed it, weddings, as well as food, business, New York, national news, and more. Kate and I overlap briefly, but don't worry, we already did the whole degrees of separation thing, so you won't have to listen to it. Since leaving the Times, Kate's work has also appeared, well, in the Times, obviously, Southern Living, Our State, and other publications, and she's now washed up in North Carolina, which we haven't really talked about yet. We're going to, but anyway, welcome. Kate, I'm so glad you're here with me.
Thank you for having me. I'm so glad to be here, truly.
We're going to have a great time. Y'all, I asked Kate, you know that we invite guests on because there's something that we would love to talk about that I also think you would be interested in. And my primary reason for putting Kate on the hot seat today is that I really wanted to talk about the sort of tell-all memoir that has a workplace flair. Kate and I have the New York Times in common as a former workplace. The New York Times is a workplace. I'm trying to think of a good adjective here. And the fact that I have to hesitate over my adjectives maybe tells you what you need to know about the Times. It can be a tense and difficult place, and working there is an honor and a privilege and a joy, and also really, really tough. So, I mean, I'm not going to plunge right in. First, tell everybody who hasn't read the book, as I have, just a little bit about what it is and what it was you were doing, so they'll have an idea of why I wanted to talk about it so much.
Sure. So this is, Mergers is about my time as a weddings writer at the New York Times. I came to the Times right out of college. I was 22, 23 when I joined. And I essentially fell into my dream job, which is writing about weddings. I didn't know it was my dream job until I got there, but it turned out to be. And so I wrote the wedding announcements. And for people who aren't familiar with them, having your wedding announcement in the New York Times is, for a certain sect of society, an enormous deal and a huge deal. And they're some of the most widely read pieces in the paper every Sunday. They're pored over, they're fact checked to the nth degree. And you talk to, or at least for me, it was an opportunity to talk to people and meet people in echelons that I had never before encountered growing up in the small town South. So it's a memoir of writing those wedding announcements, writing the vows columns, which are the big centerpiece stories about, crazy fancy weddings or not necessarily crazy fancy weddings. I covered one where two people got married under a bridge in Central Park. But writing about, so it's several things. It's writing about love, understanding what love is, what commitment is. It's working at the times, it's, you know, making it to the big league when you're a kid, basically. I mean, I like to say that I grew up at the times, and I think it's essentially true. And most important to me, it's a memoir of coming of age and understanding what I wanted from a relationship. And I ended up meeting the man who had become my husband at the times. And so it's a memoir of, it's a professional memoir, but also a deeply personal memoir about finding the person you end up actually you truly do want to spend your life with, even though it's fraught and weird and you're in your 20s and you don't know what's going on. And anyway, so it's all of those things in 365 pages, more or less.
More or less.
More or less.
just a few things. So talk to us a little bit about how, a couple of questions, how you decided to do a memoir of this time in your life, and also how you came to that particular structure of love and love and love in the workplace, love as a job and love in the workplace, and love.
Yes.
Love. I should have done this for the Valentine's Day episode. Yeah.
Well, I think as you and I probably both know, love is not all la 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 la. Sometimes it's which sounds terrible. I'm sure everyone's going to listen to this and be like, wait, what? Anyway, so I was lucky enough to, well, I should backtrack. So when I first started the wedding announcements, over 15 years ago now, a friend of mine who's also a reporter there, this woman, Jenny A. Lee, started saying to me immediately, this is a book. This is a book. You have to write. This is a book. You know, like young woman in New York, like she saw it.
Oh, well, she would know because she did one. Mm-hmm. I don't know when hers came out, but
it was around.
Yeah. So she was in the middle probably of writing it at that point.
Yes. Absolutely.
Jenny Eightley.
Yes.
I'll link to the show notes, everybody. Don't worry about it.
Love her. She's I adore her. She actually, when I got married, this is a true thing, and I'm sure she won't care if I share this. She was in San Francisco. My bridal shower was in Brooklyn. She took a red eye back from San Francisco to be at my bridal shower, came directly from Kennedy to wherever it was in Brooklyn, and then promptly fell asleep underneath all of the clothes, all of the coats that were on the guest bed at this apartment. And all these guests went back there and were like peeling their coats off the bed. And there's Jenny Lee just like conquered. Was, that's the mark of a good friend right there. But yep. Anyway, but so she kept saying, this is a book, this is a book. And of course I had no idea what I was doing, but it really took coming back to North Carolina, moving back and having a much more suburban existence and having the distance from New York to sort of understand what this story really was. But the key thing I think was I was very lucky to land an agent before pitching a book, before having a book proposal, before even just having sort of a nebulous idea, which is, incredibly lucky, I think, and probably pretty rare. And my first call with Jillian, my now agent, she said, well, so what did you learn? What did you learn? And no one had asked me that question before. And I thought, well, what did I learn? My God. Because again, when you're in it, you're just going through it and you need the distance and the time and the maturity to understand, I learned through talking with those people who were getting married, what commitment was or what I thought it was. And so at first I had thought, this should be a nonfiction book about the wedding announcements, but that book would be about 25 pages long, honestly, because I'm not a sociologist. I'm not Stephanie Kuntz, the book about American, I'm not in a position to write about the state of American marriage, nor do I actually care did not care at that point.
And man, you don't want to sign up to write a nonfiction book you don't care about, because I'll bet somebody would have bought that from you and there you would be for 3 years.
Yeah, exactly. With in advance sitting there. Mm-hmm. Yes. And you have to write this book or yes. So I realized through talking with Jillian and through talking with my group of writer friends, which thank God for them, that that had to be a memoir. Like I couldn't write it any other way because it had become such a personal thing to me over the years with talking with these brides and grooms, these couples learning about their relationships and why they decided to commit. And it was inextricably entwined with my time at the Times. I mean, again, that's kind of where I came of age as a true and actual functioning adult, more or less. You know, I bought my first pair of work pants to go work at the Times. So, and I, you know, I ended up meeting my husband there, and we went through a lot within those walls. Like we fought in the cafeteria, you know, we planned our wedding while drinking a cup of coffee down at the Dina De Luca downstairs, you know, and facing Port Authority. And then we went through much harder stuff. We went from our fertility treatments to work and talked about it, you know? And so our young adult lives, like the formation of a relationship is inside that building. And it mm-hmm. just felt like there's no way to disentangle the two. And so it had to be a memoir and it had to be in that arc. I just couldn't see it any other way.
And how did you figure out, I guess, how much time to put into the, did you have a plan for how much would be personal and how much would be timesy and worky? And did you stick to it? Or did it just sort of
It took me, I think you'll probably relate to this. It took me 18 months to think about the book. It took me about 7 weeks to write the book.
I can understand that.
Because mm-hmm. as someone who is used to being on deadline, that was what I needed. I needed, and this kind of sounds pathetic, I have to say, I needed my editor sending me these notes saying, hey, love to see some chapters, love to see. And it took me until about 2 months before the book was due to really sit down and structure it out. I did have a structure. And it really did pretty closely hew to the proposal itself mm-hmm. in terms of the things that I wanted to talk about. When I wrote the book proposal, I had the factual stuff I wanted to talk about or the research in hand, basically, like the themes for each chapter. But I did not necessarily have the personal anecdotes and the stories that needed to go along with those. But I knew them. I mean, obviously, I knew them.
Right.
The one chapter I did not have planned at all was the chapter, to me, it's the fulcrum for the book or the fulcrum for my personal story, the chapter about my grandmother when she dies mm-hmm. and the little church around the corner. And that actually, so the little church around the corner was something I had been planning on writing about separately for years because I felt the story about all these couples getting married in wartime. So the little church around the corner was a place, it is still a church in New York, which during World War II, you needed very little paperwork and no parental approval to get married. And a lot of people before they shipped off or before the men would ship off, thousands and thousands of couples were married between 1941 and 1945 at this church. I mean, you had to stand online to get married. And my grandparents got married. I mean, literally you had to almost take a number and like wait for people to cycle through. And so my grandparents got married there. And to me, it had always been a really special place, but I had also spent a lot of time in the records there. Anyway, all this to say, that was the chapter and the personal part about that chapter was the only thing that I hadn't planned out. So I had planned sort of the arc of the memoir in terms of the social and anthropological points I wanted to mm-hmm. hit, mm-hmm. but the actual plot, the plot of the personal story, I hadn't figured out until I just got it.
So you knew... And for readers who haven't read it, so you knew to some extent that it would start as you're sort of finding your way to the Times and you're dating someone else at that point, and then progress through starting at the Times as well as meeting your current husband, and then progress from there through both your time at the weddings desk and the developing relationship and then the struggles of the relationship and then get you, it kind of ends with wedding bells pretty basically.
Basically.
Yeah. Yeah. Basically, yeah. As, you know, as the best books do.
Well, I mean, that's the other, like, it would be hard. I mean, I'm grateful that I had wedding bells for it to end on, but it would make me feel weird to not end it on that in some way, or at least a recap of the State of the Union.
Right.
You know?
Right. So you knew that personal timeline. mm-hmm. but not exactly the narrative is kind yes. of what I'm hearing.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I didn't know, you know, this sounds sort of counterintuitive since I was writing a memoir, but I didn't know how personal it was really, I was really going to get mm-hmm. until I got there. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm grateful to my husband. Like, he actually wanted me to get even, I wouldn't say dirtier, but share, he pushed me to share more and to go deeper. And even, you know, maybe not necessarily to his detriment, but, you know, I'm pretty brutally honest about our relationships up and downs and our foibles. And I knew that I wanted to shine as clear a light as possible. I just didn't know how clear that light was going to have to be to really feel like I was telling the truth.
I feel like it would be easy to imagine. So here you are and you have this, like Jennifer said, it's, you know, this is a book. Right. You clearly have that, like, especially, you know, especially if you manage to fall in love and get married at the times while you're working in the wedding section. I mean, you can pitch that as a memoir. There's your hook right there. And no element of what really happened to you internally has to be in that pitch, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you can say to someone, you know, I would like to write this story about my life writing about weddings at the same time as I fell in love and ended up getting married myself. And I think that editor is going to be like, sure, that's interesting. Let's at least pursue that. I could totally see why you might have imagined that you could pull it off without doing much more than scrape the surface. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of interesting for listeners that are thinking about memoir. I think that's probably not an uncommon thing to imagine. Like, you could even imagine, you know, the most famous memoir of all time, which coincidentally I have sitting behind me, is Eat, Pray, Love. You can totally imagine her going, well, it's going to be about my eating in Italy and then traveling to this place and then, you know, going to this island and like, it's just going to be about my travels, and then having it turn out to be about really about, right. you know, like the most emotional, raw things that maybe she didn't even necessarily realize she was writing about. So that's kind of I think that's something it's easier not to think about when you're pitching memoir than you would realize.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it's one of those things that, again, at least for me, I mean, I'm not really a planner in general, but you don't realize it until you're in it. But, you know, one of the main things that every writer knows, even if you don't want to acknowledge it at times, is that you have to tell the truth. And telling the truth is never on the surface. I mean, you know, it is, sure. You, like, you got from point A to point B, that is a fact.
Right. But
as we know, a truth is much more complicated than that. And so, you know, again, I am really lucky to have a spouse who pushed me on that, particularly in terms of talking about our relationship and fighting, I guess, which is entertaining in a literary sense. Like, reading mm-hmm. about someone else's fighting is funny, but of course, when you're in it, it's not funny at all. Writing about, you know, revisiting my grandmother's death, which is still hard, mm-hmm. you know, 12, 15 years after the fact, revisiting all these things that we had put behind us or had woven into the fabric of our relationship to make it what it is now. Yeah, you don't think about those things when you sign on the dotted line with Penguin Random House. You're like, great, I'm going to write a book. This is cool, amazing. I'm so excited. It's my life's dream. And then you get into it and you're like, oh, the map doesn't go this way. You know, the map goes this way instead.
Well, let's talk about sort of, I guess, how you did that. So you had a proposal, and like you said, it had the themes and sort of what the various chapters were. But then there's a lot of detail in the book that I would not personally, I mean, my time at the Times is actually more recent than yours, and I wouldn't remember all that stuff. So how did you come up with the kinds of details that you were able to include? Like, you know, where were the memories, I guess? And what, I guess, did remembering something sort of lead you to other things?
Well, yes. And it turns out that memory is incredibly slippery. So thank God for years of GChat. A lot of that stuff. So I have a running GChat, God, I'm so old, with my best friend who lives in Colorado, and it's all in the history. I mean, not all of it, because GChat only goes back to what, 2008 or something like that. But a lot of the tentpole stories in the book, let me think, for example, like the one where in which I see my husband naked for the first time, but he's actually on stage, you know.
You barely met.
Yeah, I know. But there he is. We actually had dinner with the people who were in that chapter a couple of weeks ago. We were in New York with Brett and Steven, and Brett had read the book and he was dying laughing. He said, yes, that's exactly what happened. So I had people who were in those memories as well corroborate things for me. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Fellow employees at the Times reminded me of things and corrected me when I was wrong. But I also, and I should have pulled it out, I have a stack of original wedding announcement submissions that I was not supposed to take, but I knew there was a book somewhere. So,
yep.
So I have that original source material. So it's a combination of, you know, having these things, having emails, and that I corroborated almost everything with friends who were there. And I will say, you know, the details have been changed, or the identifying details have been changed,
right,
to protect the innocent, of course, mm-hmm, for me and my poor husband. But so it was, and I also, you know, I have a, sounds bizarre, but I have a memory like a steel trap.
That's amazing. I have a memory like a steel sieve. Make.
I have
like one of those. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You can picture. Yeah.
I mean, I can't remember what we had for dinner last night, but I can remember, you know, the pink cashmere short sleeve sweater from the Limited I was wearing when my husband and I kissed for the first time on the steps of the New York Public Library. And also a size jeans I was wearing.
Okay. Which,
not this size.
Important stuff. Important to take stuff up in your memory. Yeah. So I can remember the lyrics to the theme song for Inspector Gadget. So that's also useful.
There you go. There you go. The brain remembers what it wants to remember. You know,
yes.
The important things, except maybe not to go get gas before. You...
Anyway. I still can't remember what I was reading last week. So.
Right. Right. So, but a lot of people ask me that question, including my own mother. You know, she's asked me, like, how do you do that? And it's all up there. It's all up there.
Well, I can imagine, and I think this would work that way for me too, that if I pulled out a wedding announcement that I had submitted, or in my case, if I pulled out a motherlode column, I would remember the writing of it, mm-hmm, in a way that I don't, I wouldn't just, if you were like, you know, May 3rd, 2015, what were you doing? I'd be like, I have no idea. But if you gave me that motherlode column, I could tell you, oh, yeah, I wanted this to be about such and such, but, you know, Frank and Copy wouldn't let me have that headline, and I had to, or whatever. Mm-hmm. You know, I would have stuff. So kudos for, you know, slipping that stat. I might have copied my entire Times email before I left, so I understand. You got to do what you got to do.
You do. And we are not the first employees there to do such things.
Well, so let's shift to that. Did you feel like you had to get anyone's approval to do this?
That's a good question. Well, you know, I have had, and still do to a certain extent, have a major case of imposter syndrome.
As we all do. This is part of why this is so easy for me to ask you.
There's that. In terms of permission at the Times, not really.
I wouldn't even know who that would be, but I would also think I needed it somehow. Like, I would be sitting there going, yes, but who? There is no one. There is no one.
I realized I just lied to you, because when I first started, when I was working on the proposal and working with my agent, I kept saying, well, first of all, I took the buyout. And mm-hmm, she kept saying, are you sure you didn't sign anything like an NDA?
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't. I mean, right, you know, we're a union, so they're not going to do that. But, and they wouldn't do that anyway. But so, you know, once I confirmed that I had not in my buyout haze signed something that locked me down, I realized, of course, there are no legal ramifications to this. been the people who with whom I'm still close at the times, the people whose respect I still value.
All two of them?
Sorry.
No, I'm sure there's lots. I'm sure there's lots and lots and lots.
Yeah. There are
lots of people leave. That's what's important.
Yes.
Here. Yeah. And people have left.
And most of the people who are either in the book or who I still count as good friends have left.
Yep.
You know, they've retired or they've, you know, gone on to other things. So that's one thing. The other thing was, so the executive editor's executive assistant used to be the secretary in weddings for years. She was there for years. And now she's worked her way up to being Dean Baquet's assistant.
Good for her.
I know. And she's great. She's wonderful. And I emailed her out of the blue and I said, would you help me jog my memory about some things? And she called me. She said, sure. You know, she's like this long, she's like from Syosset or something. You know, she's like, sure. And we spent an hour on the phone and we like gossiped and caught up. And, you know, it was there's something about having her tacit support of the project, mm-hmm. even though, you know, I hadn't even outlined it at that point. It was kind of freeing in a way. And I really do think that if I ever encountered Dean Baquet on the street, he wouldn't recognize me. But if he did, he would probably say something like, good for you.
Right.
And so, you know, but the most important person.
Once you've done something like this successfully, people are much nicer about it than they are. This is definitely an ask forgiveness, not permission situation, even to the extent that you would need to, which you don't. But I feel like once you've successfully done it, people are just like, yeah. And also, nobody is as worried about whether you should do something like that as you are. So.
No one cares. As long as it's a good read, mm-hmm. and you've been truthful about it, then like,
yeah. I mean, they care if you lie, but
yes.
Yeah. So no one do that in your mind. We didn't advise that here.
I mean, there is, so we're still good friends with many people at the times, thankfully. And one of the people, one of the characters in the book who I write about, who was a real slime ball, actually. He's no longer there. And he's no longer there, but he's still close friends with our friends. Mm. And I write about him in the book and they both read the book and they didn't say a word about that. And there's a part of me that thought, is this going to come up? I wonder. And of course it never did. And I, you know, they're not going to ruin our dinner together by bringing it up, of course. But so that maybe felt a little bit awkward to me, but in terms of, you know, I really felt like in terms of permission, and I think, I think many people probably feel this, like I had to ask permission of myself to do this.
Yes.
Really. That's all it was.
Right.
You know,
that's
the main one.
Is this, I mean, undoubtedly it's your story to tell. So it's almost more, do I have permission to take up space in the world with my story?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yep. That's really hard.
It's really hard. And, you know, quite bluntly, this is my story to tell. I'm the only person who can tell this story. But this story, this is going to sound weird, but like Joe Schmo could have written that story as long as they had the same story. Like the writers, because I'm not anybody famous. You know, I'm
right.
not Witherspoon who happened to do this. I'm not Mindy Kaling or whoever. So there, and to me, there still is a little bit of like, why am I reading this person's story? Well, you're reading the story because it's a romantic story that happened to take place in the New York Times. And that if you pick up this book, that's to me why you're reading the story.
Yeah. Yeah. The gossipy element. I mean, it's both. It's the joy of being in somebody else's head, which is why we read memoir in the first place, because our own heads suck. And getting into someone else's is a different, you know, that you can leave that suck between the pages of the book. So that's wonderful. And if you're fascinated by the New York Times wedding pages, as many of us are, then the inside look at that is fantastic. And if you're fascinated by the times in that world of journalism and the way that it has evolved, there's that. And if you just like a good love story, again, that isn't your fault or your problem, then you get that, you know, you get so much. Well, it's just true. Like, yeah. Yeah.
Fault is a good word for that.
Fault is a good, like, if you really want to read about people doing stupid things that aren't you and aren't your fault, then you can do that. But because otherwise it wouldn't be a memoir. Like if it was just a memoir of your perfect life, no one would be interested in, no matter how much of the New York Times you put into it. I don't think anyway.
No.
I think there are worlds that are so shady and weird that maybe you could, like, if you, I don't even know, like, even if you look at, like, that prison memoir, which, hey, that's not experience I've ever had. I want to hear more about that, right?
Right.
She put herself and her thoughts into it. I don't know that there's anything really that works unless you get, unless you're both experiencing the thing and experience the way that the writer experienced the thing.
You gotta get dirty.
Yeah.
You gotta get dirty. And I don't mean like, you know, in a sexual way. I just mean
gotta
like get those details that make you go, oh, and also, oh.
Mm-hmm.
I think you really have to help because everybody has had these experiences in some way, shape, or form. And I don't mean like falling deeply in love or having a roller coaster relationship. I just mean like, you know, being in your 20s and not knowing what you're doing, or being obsessed with your jean size, or
being in that office and, you know, writing all the basic wedding announcements and sort of not daring to ask to do a vows column for a while.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Everybody's had the echo of that experience where they're like, you know, I think I might be ready to move on from running the copy machine to answering the phones, but I'm a little scared to, and then, you know, like 10 minutes after you ask to answer the phones, you're like, oh, no one else wants to do this anyway. I love the part about no one wanting to write the stories, the neediest
case.
Which, yeah, I love. And I had no idea. I mean, I spent however many years at the Times, and I didn't know I could have been like, I'll write a neediest cases.
Mm-hmm.
Plenty of stuff like that. But
and you get paid extra because it was outside your purview as whatever your union category was. I think it was like an extra $150 or something like that.
Which meant something.
It did.
The odds. Yeah. To a 20-year-old in New York.
It did. And writing, well, I will say like that kind of worked too. Like that was how Clerks got bylines, you know, like mm-hmm. that was how, and I write about it, like that was how these Clerks and these young kids who came there so early, like me, that's how they were able to make themselves known in the paper. I mean, you don't move up because you answer the phones really well in a
right.
newsroom, you know, you yeah. move up because you write and you write. So,
yeah. So, as we've discussed, the Times is a place that really sort of, grabs you and clutches you and digs its way into your soul and, brings out all your insecurities about everything because everyone else is better at everything than you are and you don't really belong there. And everyone at the Times, well, every woman at the Times feels that way, and many of the men.
I think most people in general.
I think most people in general. There are exceptions.
Mm-hmm.
And slime balls, all of them. But see, there are exceptions. But by and large, every single person at the Times is sitting there going, oh my God, I don't belong here. And everyone mm-hmm. else does. And geez, I don't hardly know any of these people. Look, all these other cool people know everyone. And then you eventually realize that's wrong. So I guess one of my questions is, how long did it take you to get over the place well enough to write about it?
Oh God, I don't know if I'm still over it, honestly. You know, God, that's a good question. And truthfully, I'm still not over the place. Like you know, I was in New York a couple of weeks ago and I said, well, do you want to walk by the old building? And my husband said, no, we've seen it. You know, we know what it looks like. Still the same. And no one goes, you know, it's probably empty anyway. And I kept thinking, God, do I need to go by? Like, what if I run into somebody? What if I run into somebody I know? Oh my God. What if it's somebody I really respect? And then I would freak out and I would like run away and it would be terrible all over again. So I don't, there's a part of me that's not ever going to get over this place. And especially, you know, I got there when I was like 22, like spending mm-hmm. your 20s at a place like that is really, really interesting and challenging. It definitely took me a year or two being back in North Carolina and being completely away from it. I had been out of the Times for about 2.5 years when I started really pitching this and writing the proposal. A couple of months ago, so there's this there's this gathering of Times alumni. They do it once a month, and this guy Matt Wald runs it, and it's great. It's like a round table, and it's people like the old deputy national editor who's like 97 years, I mean, literally 97 years old, to people who've taken the buyout and are living on their farm in Vermont, you know, whatever. And so Matt emailed me and asked me if I wanted to be on there and talk about the book. And I swear to you, that was the most nervous about an event I have ever been. I mean, I have done book talks galore. I have been on the Today Show. I have been on NPR. Like, I have been on WNYC. Like, I've done all of these media, like these pretty big, made, you know, national media appearances. But that little call with people, you know, half of them, you can only see their foreheads because they're like sitting away from the camera, really unnerved me. And I realized, like, it was almost like going back to this bizarre fractured family, although I would never say that any workplace is a family, but it's encountering these people who knew me when I was very young and see me now, much older. And so I don't know that I've gotten over it enough to ever say, ugh, whatever, I don't care. Cause I do care. Because the Times made much of who I am, but I don't think I'm answering your question in any succinct way at all. I think it's an evolving process, you know, and if this thing ever gets made into a movie, then that's going to be another hurdle to, you know, emotional hurdle to jump over. But,
and you wrote very affectionately, but also honestly about one of your bosses there, who was sort of an iconic figure of the wedding pages. Was that hard to do? I know, you know, he's had some health problems that probably affected his ability to.
Well, he was actually on that Zoom call.
Oh, wow.
And I
I know.
And he's the sweetest. So he emails me every so often just because his son happens to live in the same area where my dad lives. And anyway, he's just the sweetest, kindest, most generous of men, truly, to this day. And, you know, his health, he had a massive stroke. And one of the things that I didn't know, and he won't care if I share this, when I was talking to the admin, she was telling me about Bob. I write in the book with his old name is Bob. She was telling me about in detail about Bob's stroke and his health problems. And she said, but you know, he came in about a year ago and he had stopped dyeing his hair. And I said, what? And she said, he dyed his hair. And he had this like major mustache too. And he like dyed his hair and his mustache. And so when I saw him on screen, like gray haired and with a gray mustache, it was almost like I wasn't talking to the same person. And so maybe that was helpful that he stopped, you know, buying just for men.
Thank you.
So writing about the characters that were complicated, I think, I really worked hard to get that right because he was so kind, but also he could be such a jet, you know, he was so hard as a boss. But I felt that I owed it to all of these different people across the book, real and composite, to make sure that I was generous to them where I needed to be generous. And so I think that effort was helpful to me to sort of get past feeling weird about writing about people at the Times, you know?
Yeah, definitely. I have one last question, and I'll ask it a little differently than I was going to in case I got it wrong. The Times didn't cover the book, did they?
Nope. No way.
Let me just say I can relate to that. My section covered my book. So I was still part of it at the time. But the rest of it, you know, could have not happened. So thoughts, middle finger gestures you might like to make on the Zoom that viewers won't like to see?
Well, I will say they have another chance. The paperback is coming out April 5th, which I just learned today.
Are you listening to us, Pamela Paul? She's not.
She's in the book. She's in the damn book.
I know
book.
She is.
She wrote this great book about you know, Cinderella weddings and marriages. Anyway, which I have somewhere. I will say a couple of things. Number one, I have you and I share a fabulous publicist at Putnam, who is truly wonderful. And when I got the list of media appearances and possible, I mean, this thing was, it was all over the place.
Yeah.
I was completely stunned by how much interest there was. Now, if that translated into sales, I don't know. It was a pandemic, you know?
Yeah.
Sales numbers for first-time authors are weird. I'll just say that. But The only major newspaper that wrote about it was the Boston Globe. The Post didn't cover it. None of the New York dailies covered it. I mean, whatever. The Times certainly didn't cover it. It didn't land in publications that I had thought would have an interest in it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I was talking to somebody else about this recently. I think that this book has both a very broad audience, because you're talking about love and marriage and commitment and weddings and blah, 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 but also an extremely narrow one. Because again, I'm not a recognizable person,
mm-hmm.
you know, not yet, or whatever that's worth. It's about the New York Times, which a lot of people in America don't care about. They don't read
or actively hate.
Yes, exactly.
That's how my dad feels about it. So now let's dig into my psyche.
I'm teaching. I'm teaching a wonderful group of kids this semester at the J School at UNC, and several of them are not enthused by my former employment at the New York Times. And these are kids, but anyway, this is fine. It's fine. Anyway, there's a part of me that's still like, oh, come on, guys. How hard is this?
Yeah. Yeah.
Come on.
Really? Like a squib? You can't like do something funny about, just put it online. Like, you don't need to put it on print, which I know y'all still care about, even though nobody else does.
Yes. 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 And the thing too is that, so they have a new weddings editor. The announcements have changed completely. Anybody mm-hmm. who reads them knows that they've turned into mini vows now. You're not getting like the old traditional, you know, Kate Doty and Michael McElroy or Mary.
Which is the one I remember. I only remember the print one. I've actually never looked at them online because I'm old now and I don't care anymore.
I know. But the thing is, I mean, those mini vows are still consistently on like the top 10 most read lists that they used to have on the side. So yes, there's a part of me that's like, all right, guys, but you know, my publicist tried to pitch a modern love, and we were talking about what we were doing for paperback, and she said she's never broken through with modern love. Like, it's so hard, you know, that part of the paper is so hard, which you all know. But yeah, there's a little part of me that's like, you could do it.
Come on,
just do it in the manager and manner. Just be funny about it. Just acknowledge what the book is. It's not some tell-all about someone having an affair with somebody else. It's just about this thing.
Yeah. Yeah. No.
But
and people would be interested. They really would be. Because they're inherently the people that are interested in the there's no, the overlap is complete. It's not even a Venn diagram. The people who are reading your page are the people who would be interested in this book. And they would be, like, as a genuine service to them. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And yet.
And yet. Yeah.
It's okay. You know, we move on. And okay. As my wonderful editor, Michelle, said, you know, I think this book has a long tail. So hopefully it'll be of interest to many people for many years. So we'll see.
I love it. All right. Well, let's just take a second, take a breath, and then we'll try to talk about some things that we have been reading, if I can remember anything that I have been reading. I read your book. I can talk about that. Okay. Well, you get on the hot spot first. What have you been reading lately?
Okay. So I am working on a novel about a young girl who worked in a mill, got married at 12. This is true, based in truth. Married at 12, had a baby at 13, then basically ran off with the circus. And so,
cool.
I know. She actually asked her mom to take care of her kids so she could go run off with the circus. So she had to get a note from her mom, basically. This is true. This is all true. So I've been reading a lot about mill life and actually post-war Black life in the United States, because it dovetails into that. But so none of that's very important for this conversation. So I've been reading a lot of Southern female fiction, because that's just what I need to read right now to make myself feel anything other than this pandemic. But there's an author named Kay Gibbons, and she's from North Carolina, and she wrote a lot back in the 90s. She wrote a book called Ellen Foster, which I think they turned into a movie at some point. And she has this extraordinary voice and a way of capturing women that is, I find, endearing and intriguing. And she captures women's interiors, I think, in a way that is fantastic. So I've read A Cure for Dreams and Charms for the Easy Life. And those are two I've read many times, I have to say, but hadn't read them in a long time. I also read, I just finished reading Having and Being Had by Eula Biss.
Oh, I like that so much. And you're the only person I've talked to who's also read it. What did you think?
Well, so I read On Immunity, which came out, what, several years ago. Of course, I mean, talk about being prescient. But so Having and Being Had is about her basically journey into like middle class consumerism.
Yes. Yes.
And I liked it a lot. I love her voice and I love where she takes things and then how she brings it all back. There's a part of me until I got to a certain point in the book, I sort of felt like this is sort of much ado about nothing. Like these are the lives that we live, but she's one of those people who finds it necessary and it's important for her to slow it down, you know, to think about why buying a washing machine is so pivotal in a grown person's life. And it's not because it's the signaling of the arrival of adulthood. It's just so much more than that. And I found myself, like, when she was talking about like the Saroen ball paint, you know, the $150 gallon of basically white paint, although it's called cabbage or something.
Right. But it's like her movement into sort of the world of all birds and Saroen ball paint and brands that only a certain, you know, not just a certain an economic segment of society, but like a certain economic and political and cultural segment of society is gonna recognize. And it's not just sort of a middle class boho recognition of those things, as it is an examination of what it feels like to be there and not have set out to be. It's a lot, right?
It is a lot. And I was reading it in tandem with Learning in Public, which is by Courtney E. Martin. And she was, you know, she's a feminist in fame. And so she and her family live in a part of the Bay Area. They're in the Oakland Unified School District, and they're zoned for a very poor majority Black school. And most of the upper middle class white families that live in that area send their kids elsewhere. You know, they put them in some magnet school or they send them to like the $40,000 a year private school down the street. And she talks about the choice, the conscious choice that they make to send their kid or their daughter or their daughters now to this school, and what it's like to truly, what it really is like to truly live in community with people who are not like you. And especially for like, I mean, it's sort of a, it's completely connected to the concept of like nice white parents, you know, in the podcast and all of that. But I swear to God, she nails white people, like the kind of white person that I am, so remarkably well that I had to like put the book over my face and cringe at certain points. Like she said something about Weleda diaper cream and I was like, oh God. So those are the two things that have really kicked me in the butt recently. For sure.
I have not read Learning in Public, and I will have to find it because that is a, I mean, that's just a, that's a thing that so many people wrestle with, that question of, you know, putting your public school beliefs where your mouth is when it comes to your actual children. Not as easy as you imagine it might be when you're 22.
It is not. Yeah. And you know, like my 7-year-old goes to this magnet school and we put her in this magnet school because it's more diverse than the school that we are zoned for and economically, socially, whatever, racially. And that made it, but reading this book made me go, oh my God, what are we doing? Like, anyway, it's a great, and she's in it, you know, enormously engaging. So yeah. Everybody should read this book.
Okay. Everyone should read that book. Yes. I've not been reading anything as intense as those things. Although I did read and enjoy Mergers and Acquisitions, or Everything I Know About Love I Learned on the Wedding Pages.
Thank you.
Y'all might have already heard us talk about that a little bit. So I very much enjoyed that. I've been doing a lot of reading things and then just putting them as, like, starting it, dumping it, starting it. I've been having a hard time finding. I want something light, like, that'll pull me through, but it's not dumb. So, and actually can be dumb if it's funny. There's some sort of wild line of this. So an interesting thing that happened to me lately is that I was reading, I wanted to read a genre murder mystery. And I picked up something by an author that I had read who had never written a genre murder mystery before. And it failed completely for me in the first chapters, which is why I'm not outing the author. Because it's hard to write a book and there's just no reason to. It didn't work for me, but I thought they broke certain unwritten rules of the genre, which I used to read a lot and haven't read lately. So in that sort of vein as a writer and just being interested, I picked up Arsenic and Adobo, which is a pretty popular other genre. I mean, you know by the title of that it's, you know, genre fun murder mystery. And it's kind of interesting because I haven't read any genre fun murder mysteries probably in 15 years. And the requirements of the genre around sort of acknowledging that on the one hand, it's a genre, but on the other hand, it's about dead people have changed. And I think the one that failed for me went too far over the edge, but then this one is in a different place than the ones that I used to read. Anyway, I'm hoping to have the author on so we can have a little talk about genre and murder mysteries that will dig down into this in a deeper and different way. So that's what I've been reading lately. Arsenic and Adobo, which I do like. That one is not that's not the failed one. That one's right there with it.
Have you read any Jilly or Gilly McMillan?
I haven't.
So not this past Christmas, but the Christmas before, my husband loves horror and thriller. Mm-hmm. Love
it. I like some of that. I didn't used to, but I do now.
I am still on the fence about it, but that's his go-to. You know, he loves Stephen King, loves Joe mm-hmm. Hill, loves that anybody sort of in that wheelhouse. So, and I never read this stuff ever. But so two Christmases ago, he gave me this book called To Tell You the Truth.
Okay.
By Gilly or Jilly. I'm assuming she's British. I'm assuming it's Jilly, G-I-L-L-I, McMillan. And so it was the first Christmas of the pandemic. My parents were getting divorced. And so things were sort of fraught. And he gave me this book, and I'm not giving anything away here. It's about, in part, a four-year-old who has disappeared.
Mm-hmm.
And this was at the height of the whole pod situation. You know, we had a five-year-old who had never actually been inside her kindergarten classroom, and no one was vaccinated yet. And we were in that time period. And I read 20 pages of it, and I knew that it was going to be a great book. And it terrified me so much that I had to put it on the shelf. I was so mad because I knew I wanted to finish this book at some point, but I was not in the space to do that mm-hmm. at all.
Maybe next year.
Maybe next year. Maybe after, you know, everybody's boosted and people stop dying.
Yeah, I could totally relate to that. I've been thinking, in part because people ask me to blurb books and other things. I've been thinking about some books are just not for me. And so that's the other reason that we don't usually say it. I mean, if one of us doesn't like something by Dan Brown, we're happy to talk about that because he'll be okay.
Right.
But, you know, for us regular civilian style writers, we don't do that because just a lot of the time it's just like, this isn't for me right now. Like, I just finished something that it was like a boarding school book and I don't really like those to begin with.
Was it nonfiction?
I didn't like it, so I'm not going to go. I'm not going to out it anyway.
Never mind.
Yeah, it just wasn't for me. that's all. I can tell you, Less. There's a book that was not for me.
Won the Pulitzer, so it's going to be fine. But it wasn't for me, right?
Yes. And then, you know, it's funny. I went to boarding school, and I have yet to pick up a boarding school book and finish it. And there's a new one that's coming out that has a very different perspective on my experiences, but I still can't bring myself to pick it up because I just, I don't know.
Oh, I'll bet I know which one you're talking about, and I've just blanked on it, so sorry. I'm actually not spooking this one. It's the one about where the writer's a person of color who went...
Yes.
Yeah, I just... if I can, I'll track this down for y'all. I don't remember what it is, but it's been all over the place. Yeah, I wondered about that one, too. I was like, well, maybe I would be interested in that one, but I'm just not... I actually have a chip on my shoulder about boarding schools because it's not an experience that I had. So that's more why I don't read it. But
it's a real weird experience, I can tell you that much. I have to tell you, I returned to, and I didn't think these books were going to be for me, in part because, you know, I was just a snob for such a long time about mass market, whatever, mm-hmm. which is something we all need to get over in some way, shape, or form. But anyway, I was such a snot about Alexander McCall Smith's books.
Oh, sure.
And I had never read, or I picked up, I was like in an airport or something, and I picked up one of the number one ladies detective mm-hmm. books mm-hmm. and read the first couple of pages. And I thought, well, this is pleasant. You know, this is definitely like a beach read or whatever. But then he's got a separate series of books about a woman named Isabel Dalhousie. And she lives in Edinburgh, and she owns and edits a journal of philosophy. And these books are so... nothing actually happens in them, really.
It sounds really fun, though.
It was just great. You know, and like they walk in the park and they talk about existential things and da-da-da. And there's a mystery along the way that doesn't actually get solved. It's more of a thought, more of a thought project. But they're so cozy. They're so intensely cozy and intensely... and he's a great writer. You know, he knows how to get you from, mm-hmm. from point A to point B. And me talking with him is not going to do him any harm.
Again, yeah. There are some people we can... it's important to criticize books, but it's a fine line, right? So,
yes.
Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, this was so much fun. And I want to thank you for coming and talking so honestly about the process and everything else. If people want to find out more about the book, I can tell you that you can pick up Mergers and Acquisitions anywhere that you buy your books. Apparently, soon to be in paperback. When's that?
April 5th.
Oh, it's coming right up. So something you could do would be to pre-order the paperback, and then it will appear as a magic surprise, hopefully on the shelves of your indie bookstore where they will hand it to you wrapped up in brown paper, which is how my indie bookstore does it, as though, you know, my fresh copy of, The Husbands by Chandler Baker was some kind of, isn't that, I was like, I understand why you do this, because they used to put them in little bags, and I used to look in the bag, because you'd see somebody's name. Like, there's a couple famous authors that live around here, and I'd be like, oh, what's he reading? So I get why they do it. All right, that was a non sequitur. But anyway, you could also have, one of the major bookstores that puts books in your mail it to you. And there you would be in April. And suddenly you would have this great book in your books. And it would be like you gave yourself a present. So that's a thought.
It is a thought. And you could even if you were feeling especially generous, you could even drop a review of it somewhere. Because, like it or not, the reviews on the Big A count for a lot.
It is true. It is true. And they aren't as stuffy about you having bought it from the Big A as they used to be either.
Yeah.
So as long as they don't have some reason to think about it. So yeah, that's a lovely thought. That's something I could do. Are there any social platforms where you are particularly engaged?
I am on Instagram. You can find me under Kate Doty. It's mostly pictures of the back of my daughter's head, but I do talk about books on there, especially books I've been reading. And I lurk on Twitter. I try not to say too much just because I don't want to get in trouble at this point.
Yeah. Twitter used to be fun, but that was back in the day. All right. Well, as always, y'all can find the podcast on Facebook at Am Writing Podcast, where we have a active, enthusiastic, and crazy group of writers sharing all the things. You can email me, us, at amwriting@substack.com, especially if you have a burning question about writing that you think that we might be able to answer. That might be a great episode. We always enjoy that. And that's also where you can subscribe to get the show notes or support the podcast. And that's it for today. And because I'm the only host here, I get to say the tagline, which never happens ever, ever, never, ever, ever happens. So here I go. Until next week, y'all, keep your butt in the chair and your head in the game.
The Hashtag AmWriting podcast is produced by Andrew Perella. Our intro music, aptly titled Unemployed Monday, was written and played by Max Cohen. Andrew and Max were paid for their time and their creative output because everyone deserves to be paid for their work.
Pause, stop,
stop.
Thank you.